originating from our Jimmy John's of Lexington studios. This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Sabre wins the Derby for Todd Fletcher.
Basalt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And Dialed In never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Now here's Mike Pena.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to the show Trainers Listen To. This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. I'm Mike Pena, coming to you from our Jimmy John's of Lexington broadcast studios, wishing everyone across HRN Nation a very pleasant Wednesday afternoon. Many of you are tuned in right now live on Sirius 219 XM 206 or listening via our free live streaming or archive podcast, which is available on our HRN website, horseracingradio.net. Very happy to have you with me for the next hour or so as we again have the opportunity to visit with a trainer who continues to saddle winners and rack up leading trainer titles. He is the 67-year-old native of Washington, D.C. He is to date saddled 1,967 winners. Those runners have earned more than $35 million in purses, and he is fresh off another leading trainer title with the most earnings by his runners. Those were accumulated at the recently concluded 7-day Timonium Fair Meet, and he is with us now. He is trainer Jerry Robb here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Jerry, welcome to the program, my friend.
Thank you, Mike.
Happy to have you on board and looking forward to hearing your story. Let's start with the big news at Timonium. I mentioned your runners earning more than any other trainer's runners at that 7-day meet. You look at the pictures from Timonium. You see Ferris wheels. You see various rides. It's a festive atmosphere. How much fun is that 7 days of racing?
It's a lot of fun. I mean, years ago, I used to be 42, and I always did real well there. Lately, I've struggled there. But bounced back a little bit this year.
Yeah, you didn't struggle this year. What was the key?
Well, I did struggle this year. I only won four. The key was winning the stake.
It helps when you win the right ones, doesn't it?
Right.
It's a special place for you, too. I know you picked up your milestone win number 1,000 there years ago.
I did.
What do you remember about that day?
I think I won three in a row, and I think the thousands came in a stake with a horse called, I can't remember his name, Ronald and Ron, or Run John Run, one or the other.
Yeah, Run John Run.
There you go.
Run John Run. Do trainers think about those kind of milestones?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they're hard to get to. You're always trying to make it to it. I had made it to the 1500, and I had thought about retirement, and then I was bored and came back. So now I'm closing in on 2000.
Is that the next goal?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Yeah. How do you approach it when you're coming up to a big milestone like that? Is that like all consuming, or do you just say, hey, let's just get there when we get there?
Nah, right now it's just we'll get there when we get there. When we get close, it might be a different story.
when you were getting close to 1,000, was it one of those situations where, like we hear about that in other sports, where all of a sudden the hitter goes into a slump or, a guy's getting close to throwing a record number of touchdown passes and they just can't get over that hump? Was it easy for you, or did you have to work for it a little bit?
No, that one came pretty easy because we were at Timonium, and back then I was winning half my starts there. So it was a lot easier at Timonium than it would have been at Laurel or Pimlico.
What was Timonium like back in the day?
He had the same horses. It was just part of the Maryland circuit at the time. And the half-mile races were different. You know, three-quarters was as short as you found on the dirt at Bowie or Laurel. So a lot of babies. It was a good place to start young babies.
So where does a guy from Washington, D.C., how does a guy from Washington, D.C. end up getting hooked on horse racing and getting involved in the sport?
Well, my dad was always the fan, a gambler at the track, and I used to hide in the car to sneak to the races with him. And then after I started, out of high school, I started a job. The engineer at our building had horses, and he needed an exercise rider. So he taught me how to ride, and I started galloping horses for him, and then went to the track with him. His name was James McGill.
Okay.
And that's how I started.
Did you have aspirations of being a jockey at any point?
I rode one race at the flat at one of the fairs and finished second. And that was the only time. I tried to get light enough. I couldn't get light enough. I got down to like 128, as light as I could get.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, especially when I'm looking at 250 now.
Yeah, big difference, right?
Oh, yeah, half of me.
Jerry Robb with us here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton here on HRN. Tell me a little bit more about your dad. You said he liked to gamble.
Yeah, he was a meat cutter, but he was a big horse fan, racing fan. He was always listening to the races on the radio back then and going to Bowie and then Charlestown every Saturday.
I like your dad listening to the races on radio. That's music to my ears.
Yeah, well, back then that's all they had.
Yeah. So you said you would sneak in the car with him. What would you do, like hide out in the back seat?
Yeah, I would know where he was headed. I could see him gathering the stuff together, and I'd go out the back door and sneak around the front and get in the back seat and hide down on the floorboard until I knew he was too late to miss the double, and then I'd pop up.
Well, I was going to say, did he knew you were there?
No, I'm sure he did it later on, but the first few times I tricked him pretty good.
So would he teach you, like when he knew that you were there with him and he had to kind of take you, would he teach you about the game?
Yeah, he taught me how to read a racing form and handicap, and I used to run his bets for him. I'd go to the window and get somebody to make the bets for him.
And at that time, it was completely different, right, in terms of kids being around the racetrack and the gambling aspect of it?
Yeah, there was very few kids at all, and it was always a large crowd there.
Yeah, yeah. What racetrack was that?
Bowie.
Okay. Tell me about Bowie, because that's where I've heard many people get their start at Bowie.
I started my first stabling in Maryland. I broke my maiden at Penn National, but I was stabled at Bowie at the time, what they called Blueberry Hill.
Mm-hmm.
That's now housing development. But Bowie always had the best racing surface for winter. I mean, we ran there when it was 2 foot of snow on the ground.
Yeah.
And was snowed in there a few times from running while it was snowing. So it's a different animal than today, that's for sure.
Do you miss it?
At times. I mean, you get frustrated when you get a bunch in and you prep to run and you get there and it starts sprinkling snow and they cancel the races.
Yeah.
You know, when you look back at what you've done before.
So did you always think, like when you were sneaking in the car in the back seat with your father and you would go to the races, did you always think someday you were going to be working in the sport?
No, not at all.
What else did you think about doing?
That all started when I started galloping horses and working with Mickey McGill. And once the bug bites you, you're stuck.
Yeah. Yeah. What else did you think about doing?
I was working as a meat cutter at the time. I was a butcher.
Following in your dad's footsteps.
Yeah. Well, he got me the job and put me to work the day after I graduated.
Wow. Well, how long did you do that?
I did it for about a year, and then I worked. When I first started training, I was working as a meat cutter at Safeway and Giant part-time just to make sure I got the bills paid until I got rolling.
So when you first met Mickey, how did that relationship come about?
He was an engineer at the place where we work at the meat supply house.
Okay.
And he needed somebody. He had three racehorses, and he needed somebody to get on them at his house. So he hustled me into going to the house and taught me how to ride.
And you had never been on a horse before?
No.
Wow. How'd that go the first time?
The first horse he put me on was a horse called Plastic Gary, who ended up being a stakes winner. But Mickey and them would laugh. I'd ride down the field, and the horse would come back without me every day.
Where
so
was that?
Getting fit, so it's working.
Where was that, Jerry?
That was in Oxon Hill, a little farm he had in Oxon Hill, Maryland.
Wow. Wow. Jerry Robb here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton, as you can hear, has now, well, he's closing in anyway, on 2,000 career victories, but it didn't exactly start out on a high note because he was falling off of horses galloping for Mickey McGill, and now look at him now. Jerry, do you ever spend time and think about those days and say, wow, I can't believe how far I've come?
Not all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, there's so many people in this business that, you know, come and go and don't make it, and to still be here, you think about it every day.
Yeah. Yeah. So what was the thing that got you into training? What made you decide to go that direction?
I bought a horse for $1,000 off of Hal Claggett.
Okay.
Who was a big breeder in Maryland. And I gave the horse time, and I bought him back, and I went like 15 races with him the first 2 years. And after the first year, I bought another one from him called Bold Staff, who wins 7 or 8. So he called me and told me if I was going to win any more races with his horses, he was going to own them, so he hired me.
What year was that?
I'm guessing, but I'm going to say 78, 79.
Okay.
And I guess might have been a little earlier.
Yeah, and at that point, like you said earlier, once the bug bites you, you're kind of into it. You're hooked. So at that point, you train your first winner. Now it's in full swing, right?
Oh, yeah. And I trained for Mr. Claggett 30 years. He ended up being a leading breeder in Maryland many years, and we had a lot of success together.
Yeah, it's great when you can have those types of relationships, those long-term, because they're, let's face it, Jerry, those can be rare when you're in the training profession, but to be able to maintain that relationship for so long and have so much success together, that's a special thing, isn't it?
Yeah, it was.
What made him such a good breeder?
He ended up having a lot of Bold Ambition mares that weren't doing well, and then he bought interest in a horse called John Alden.
Mm-hmm.
And those horses, the John Aldens, the only runners he had were all Bold Ambition mares. So he just stumbled across the nick or found the nick, however he did it, and it just worked out very well for us.
Yeah, it worked out extremely well, and you went on to have a lot of success together. You talk about John Alden. That brings us to the name Little Bold John, who turned out to be a pretty darn good horse in his own right. Maryland bred, was the top Maryland bred for a long time until a horse by the name of Ben's Cat came along and surpassed him. Take me back to Little Bold John. Tell me that story.
Little Bold John belonged to Mr. Claggett, and I ran him in the Tri-State Futurity, I think his third start, and he won and was disqualified. And the next day, or might have been the day after, somebody was in my shed row looking for him, and I asked him, could I help you? And he says, yeah, I bought Little Bold John. I'm here to get him vetted. And, of course, I knew nothing about it. So I called Mr. Clegg, and I told him, he says, yeah, I needed the money. I sold him. And I said, well, has he paid you yet? And he said, no. I said, well, why don't you let me buy him, and that way he'll stay in Maryland, because these people were from Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
So I called the client, and he says, if you like him that much, why don't you buy him? I said, if I had the money, I would. So he put up the money, and I end up owning half of him.
Wow.
So it worked out great. And about a year later, somebody offered us some money, and I sold my half back to the original owner, Mr. Owens, because he didn't want to sell the horse. And I'm glad he didn't, because he went on to make close to $2 million, and I think he won 25, 26 stake races. A lot of fun with him.
Yeah, 1,956,000 was the total for Little Bold John when he retired. He started, how about this? He started 105 times. He won 38 of those 105 starts. Incredible.
Yep, he was something else. And he really never showed a lot of talent. He just had a lion heart. And he didn't want to lose. I can remember a race at Pumlico where those two horses squeezed him, and he reached over and bit one of them and kicked the other one and took the lead. And he was just that type of horse.
Well, and he had to overcome a lot in his career, too, didn't he?
Yeah, he had a few minor injuries, but most of them he caused himself, because he would kick at anything that moved.
Mm-hmm.
And he would kick the wall a lot. Most of his injuries came from his hind end. But I believe he won his last start when I retired.
Yeah, he did. He did back at Laurel Park, right?
Yeah.
1992.
Yeah, it was at Laurel.
Yeah, 1992. He did. He went out on a winning note. That had to be special.
It was. I mean, it just the way he won that race, and you could tell he was struggling, but he wasn't going to give. I just didn't have the heart to ever run him again after that. I didn't want to see him get hurt.
Yeah. You know, Jerry, it's interesting. We have added to our race broadcast schedule here on the network. Last year, we added on-site coverage of the Maryland Million, and we had been broadcasting the race for the past several years, but last year had the chance to go to Laurel and broadcast it live on site, and it was such a special show for us. We were treated so well by everybody in Maryland. And you look at Little Bull John, and on his resume, you see a victory in the 1987 running of the Maryland Million Classic. That was the second year that the Maryland Million Classic was run. That had to be, for you, especially being from Washington, D.C., and having this horse be a Maryland bred, that had to be a special win, too.
That was a very special win for a lot of reasons. I mean, the Maryland Million was won, but the big thing was him. And I got to the track that morning, and his back leg was all stoved up. He had cut it, and it was all swollen up. He could hardly move. And I had him out on the chute at Bowie, jogging him all morning long, getting it down. And worked on it from 6 in the morning till 5 in the afternoon when he ran, and had no idea how he was going to run on it.
Wow.
But he won easy that day.
How do you, as a trainer, how do you deal with something like that? You said you worked on it all day long. What did you do?
I ate hosing. I mean, it was just the neck, and it cut it, and it blew up overnight, and when they blow up like that, they get real stiff on it until you get it down, and exercise is usually the best thing to get it down if it's superficial like it was.
Mm-hmm.
So, icing, hosing, and walking.
How about when he took the Don Handicap in 87?
That was very special. Beat Lady Secret. The week before, I run him in the sprint there, and he beat Smile. And he run against two horse of the years within a two-week period down there. So that was a great trip for us.
At what point did you know that this horse could be special?
It was never a point. It was just each race got better and better and better. And then he got to the point where he expected himself to win. He's kind of like this filly Anna's Bandit. I mean, she's pretty much the same way, a lot of heart.
You know, I read somewhere that when you were getting ready to, you were preparing to run him in the 92 Maryland Million Classic. He was going to be 10 years old. And you talked about the fact that he was such a seasoned campaigner that even if something didn't feel right to him during the race, that he would always protect himself. And he was a very smart horse like that. Is that true?
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, he was very, very consistent. But back in the day, they used to run a mile at Laurel out of the chute.
Okay.
And when you came out of the chute and went to the main track, you'd hit the bank end of that turn. You know, it wasn't a flat run out of that chute. It kind of banked into the – you floated into the turn that was banked.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't like that. I mean, I don't think he ever ran a good race going a mile. He'd come out of that chute and felt that and just eased himself up and wouldn't run on it.
Yeah.
So I guess that's why he stayed around for 10 years, still running, so –
yeah.
And if he didn't like something, he protected himself. But he won on turf, dirt, mud, fast, frozen. He just didn't like that track the way it banked into that turn.
What was the day like when we talked about him going out on a winning note, but what was the day like when you finally had to retire him and say goodbye?
A relief, because every time I ran him, I wanted him to go out sound, and he did. I didn't want him to hurt himself. I didn't want him to end his career that way.
Yeah, yeah.
So it was a relief, because when they get that old and have so many old injuries, I mean, he had cracked cannon bone when he was a two-year-old. He had suspensions in his back legs from kicking the wall. There was always something minor with him, but I just wanted him to leave there in one piece, that's all.
When you bring him back from an injury like that and he goes to the starting gate that first time back, for you, as somebody who spent so much time with him and as his trainer, what What's that moment like? Are you nervous that something could go wrong again, or are you confident that we got this right and I'm not worried about it?
The cannon bone, when that healed up, you were pretty confident because them things usually heal stronger than they were previously.
Mm-hmm.
The suspensories are a different situation. All it takes one bad step to tear them again. So,
mm-hmm.
You know, it would depend on what injury he was coming back from.
So were you holding your breath the whole way around the track as you're watching him run in that comeback race?
No, he never ran. I was confident when I ran him that he was going to be fine.
Yeah. Interesting. 25 career stakes victories for a very special horse who went by the name of Little Bull John. I mentioned he was the all-time leading Maryland bred. At one point, Ben's Cat came along in 2016 and surpassed that mark. Were you cheering for Ben's Cat to pass him?
I was. I mean, Ben's Cat was the same thing. I think he broke his pelvis as a baby,
mm-hmm.
and he was running injured his whole life. I mean, he was a war horse also. Get one every once in a while that wants to win and don't know how to lose, and they'll give you everything they have. And he was one of them.
Yeah, he certainly was. He was very, very special. Jerry, talk about the Maryland program. And you know, it's such a rich history there in Maryland, and we talk about that a lot when we come to Preakness and when we go to Maryland Million every year, but there's so much history there. What's it like being part of that? And you're part of that history. What's that like?
It's an everyday challenge. I mean, so much has changed. I mean, there used to be a day not too long ago where you would only have two or three turf races a day. Now they run five or six, so you pretty much got to change your whole stable to adapt to what they're doing. I mean, when you have six turf races a day, that only leaves three for the dirt, so it's really tough to run your dirt horses.
How many horses?
This time of year.
Yeah, how many horses do you have in training now?
Right now I have 28 in training.
Okay. What's the most that you ever got up to?
I had 60 in my barn when I trained for Mike Gill.
Mm-hmm.
And I was overseeing 400, so.
How do you keep that straight?
Pardon me?
How do you keep that straight when you're overseeing 400 horses? How do you do it?
24/7.
I believe it. Did
and
you have?
He had you on the phone, 20 of those 24.
Yeah. Yeah. How many assistants did you have? How many assistants did you have helping you at that point?
In my barn, I had two assistants, but I mean, we had like four or five other trainers working for us also.
Yeah. Jerry Robb here on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. It's been quite a ride for Jerry. Started training horses, as you heard him say, in the 1970s and has moved on to be closing in on 2,000 victories in that career. Jerry, when you think back on all those wins, we mentioned Little Bull John, but what are some of the other horses that will stand out to you?
Lightning Paces was a very nice horse that I did well with. I had many. I think I've won probably 125, 130, maybe more. I don't even know. Stake races. So there's been and most of them came to me as babies, so I developed all of them. So there's been plenty of them that were special. I had probably the most talented horse I ever had was a horse called Crafty Guy and a filly called Pawnee Princess.
Mm-hmm. And
they were probably the two most talented I ever had. But there's plenty of them that have special places.
Yeah, do you have pictures around your house of some of these great horses?
I just remarried 2 years ago, and my wife was a trainer, and the house is full of pictures. We have a trophy room. There's probably a couple hundred trophies in it, and I have 199, she has one, and she tells everybody, come and look at our trophy room. The kids are always busting on her about that.
That's great. This has got to be a lot of fun to show off when people come over.
Yeah, that's very rewarding.
What's the trophy that if you could save only one, if something happens, you can walk out of there with just one of your trophies, what's the one that you're going to walk out with?
I guess trophy-wise, the Maryland Mayhem when Little Bull John won the Classic. But it's a toss-up. There's three races that stand out. That's one of them. The Don Handicap was one. And then the General George, he won when everybody thought he was done. That was probably the most rewarding race he won.
Yeah. Yeah. How old was he at that point?
Wow. I don't even remember. I know it was a very tough race. There was horses from all over the country in there. I think it was 6 or 7 millionaires in the race. I mean, it was a very tough race, and they counted him out. I think he went off 10-1 that day. And
yeah,
I don't know what year it was.
It sounds like, and I've had other trainers on this program over the years, Jerry, and it sounds like when you can win with a horse like that, that everybody else has disregarded and counted out, there's a sense of vindication, I guess maybe is the right word. Is that right?
Oh, absolutely. That day especially. I mean, it was Baffert, Lucas, we're all in the party room. They gave them all the seats up front, put me in the back, couldn't even see the racetrack. I mean, I was like an after, also eligible horse, supposedly, in that race.
Yeah.
And to win it. And the same thing. And I mean, there's no pressure on you in that situation, just like there wasn't in the Don. I think it was 50-1 when I won that. So, you know, those kind, you don't feel the pressure. It's when you go out there and you're 1-5 when you feel the pressure.
Yeah. Yeah. So what's it like for you when you go into a big race like that? You mentioned Lucas and Baffert and some of the big names that we've seen in the sport, Hall of Famers, and you walk into the paddock to saddle your horse. What's that moment like for you when you look around and see all those other guys?
It's exciting to be competing with them. I mean, but it's exciting to be competing at Charlestown if you have one and you think it's going to win too. So, yeah, not a whole lot of difference.
Is it difficult for a trainer that isn't named Baffert or Lucas to somehow find a way to make their way to the top of the sport?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you just look at history of racing. Most of the classic horses come from California, Kentucky, New York. You don't see them coming out of Maryland, even though we did have a run where we had a few from the Mid-Atlantic 4 or 5 years ago with Smarty Jones and Richie's horse.
Yep. Yeah, Fleet Alex.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess maybe a better way to ask that question, not so much if you're named Baffert or Lucas, but somebody with a smaller stable trying to make it and compete at the top level like that, that has to be difficult.
Yeah, you've got to have the owners to buy those type of horses, and maybe someday we'll have that in here in Maryland because we're getting better and better every year here. And California seems to be struggling pretty good, so maybe we'll end up with replacing them.
Well, he's trainer Jerry Robb. He's my special guest on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. Jerry, stay with me. Going to get to a real quick break. We'll come back and talk more about some of those top moments you've been part of throughout this career. Jerry Robb on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton.
Nominations are now open to the Fasig Tipton November Sale, the world's premier breeding stock event. The sale annually produces the highest average and median of any mixed sale in the world, and in 2018 sold 22 horses for $1 million or higher. Held the Monday after the Breeders' Cup, this one-night sale offers leading racing and broodmare prospects, proven producers, and selected yearlings in the most electric atmosphere you will find at any thoroughbred auction. Nominate your best today, the Fasig Tipton November Sale, where stars shine brightest.
Bloom Racing. Started by former jockey and 35-year racing industry veteran Jeffrey Bloom, Bloom Racing offers racing partnerships, bloodstock services, pin hooking, and private race management.
Pulling away from Come Dancing, Mopetism, and the others, Midnight Bizou leaves no doubt today. She won the Phipps in hand.
Experience the fun, excitement, and exclusive access of racehorse ownership with Bloom Racing. Forming racing partnerships now, get in on the action at bloomracing.com.
At Have you tried Daily Racing Form's Saratoga single day bundles? Get everything you need for the day, including DRF BPs, clocker reports, DRF Plus Pro, and Timeform US betting strategies. DRF Saratoga single day bundles are available with your choice of Classic Formulator or Timeform US BPs. So now you can maximize your handicapping any day of the meet with DRF Saratoga single day bundles. Visit drf.com/Saratoga to learn more.
Talking with Dr. Jim Chiappetta of Flair Equine Nasal Strips. Jim, why focus on the nose? Isn't the throat a big problem in racehorses?
Mike, when we think about the upper airway in horses, we typically end up putting on a tongue tie or operating on its throat to improve airflow. What you may find interesting is that when we measure the anatomy of the upper airway and the flow, the narrowest part that causes the greatest resistance in all horses is the nasal passages. That's where the strips work. If you want to improve airflow to the lungs, you need to consider the nasal passages.
Learn more at flarestrips.com/learn.
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Jet Ceiling and Eric Camacho down the center of the track, and they're clear now by four. Back into second, My Corinthian. In third, Hollywood Talent. A long break now to the fourth, Decajun Cat. But inside the final furlong, it's already all over. It is Debt Ceiling and Eric Camacho. They're clear now by six lengths and gearing down inside the final 16th. A perfect 3 out of 3. The Bashford Manor goes to Debt Ceiling. Hollywood Talent in second, My Corinthian in third, and Runkle was fourth.
Welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton here on HRRN. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, coming to you from our Jimmy Johns of Lexington broadcast studios. Visiting tonight with trainer Jerry Robb. And Jerry, the trainer of Debt Ceiling, started his career with Jerry and started that career successfully. 3 for 3 victories at Laurel, Pimlico, and then the Grade 3 Bashford Manor at Churchill Downs. That was Mark Johnson on the call back there in 2013. Don't forget, if you miss any portion of this show, all you have to do is head over to our website, horseracingradio.net. You can check out the podcast at your leisure. And we'll also remind you that Jerry, like all of our guests who appear on the program every week here on Trainer Talk, going to receive a gift courtesy of one of our sponsors, that is Flair Equine Nasal Strips. So we will get those out to Jerry and send those to him so he can try out the Flair strips. And we appreciate everybody who uses the Flair strips coast to coast. Jerry, that call of the Bashford Manor, what a performance that was. And to begin his career 3 for 3, Debt Ceiling, a pretty special horse.
Yeah, it was. I was listening to the call there and brought back a lot of good memories. The middle move he made in that race that night was unbelievable. He made a move on the turn, went from third or fourth to open up 3 or 4. When they were flying, I mean, it was amazing middle move he made that day. And like the announcer said, it was over at the eighth pole. He was easing him up.
Yeah, it was a special performance and a special horse too. I mean, look, I've owned horses, and to have a horse win a race, to have a horse get to the races is an accomplishment. To have a horse win a race, any race, is a major accomplishment. To get them to go 3 for 3 in the beginning of their career and win a Grade 3 is a huge accomplishment. So tell me about the early days of a horse like Debt Ceiling, what that was like for you.
From the very beginning, he showed a lot of early speed and good talent. I knew he'd do well as a 2-year-old. Coming out of that Kentucky race, he was as good as he could be, and we went to Saratoga with him expecting to win. I think he went off even money. And he drew the one hole. He broke a step slow, and they squeezed him off and bounced him around, and that kind of ended his winning streak for sure, but it also mentally hurt him quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I come back and win with him a couple races later, but he was never the same.
You know, that's a great point, and it's something that I think oftentimes gets overlooked. When you're training horses, it's not only about taking care of the physical side of the horse, but also the mental side, and that can be a massive undertaking, can it?
With some you can do anything. Like little Bold John, Eddie Gaudet used to call him trainer proof. There's no way you can mess him up.
Do you believe that?
That's what he used to tell me.
Do you believe that?
That horse is trainer proof. But some of them, like Death Sealing, I mean, that was, that one hole is brutal if you're a speed horse and you don't break good. I mean, you're, he never had any dirt in his face before. It was, everything was new to him that day.
Do you believe that Little Bull John was trainer proof?
Yeah, I did nothing special with him other than pick easy spots for him. But he was an easy horse to train. I was galloping myself at the time, so it didn't matter what you did with him. He showed up.
You mentioned how much you liked that call of Debt Ceiling winning the Bashford Manor. As we were in the commercial break, you were telling me about maybe your favorite call of all time. Which one was that?
That would be the General George with Robin Burns when he was the announcer at Laurel. And like I said, everyone had counted the horse out. I think he went off 10-1. They asked me what he was doing in the race, blah, blah, blah. And then when he took the lead at the eighth pole, the call was the champ is back.
Yeah, back in a big way, too.
So that by far was my favorite call. The Don Handicap was another story in itself. The announcer there, Sonny Hine, had two horses on. He had a rabbit in there. I can't remember the rabbit's name. But he had Skip Trowel, and he had another horse in there as a rabbit. And the announcer called the rabbit, and Little Bull John hadn't had Turner for home. And I turned to the owner and said, we can't lose from here. Well, we won by a short nose, but at the last call, he changed it back to Skip Trowel. He was calling the wrong horse the whole race.
Oh, jeez.
Right. So I would have never said anything like that had it been Skip Trowel hooking me at the top of the stretch. Actually, they hooked up at the 5-8 pole, and they went from the 5-8 pole to the wire nose apart.
Wow. Wow, and you had already beaten Skip Trowel a couple of times that year.
I believe I beat him 2 out of 3 times at the Meadowlands, but I know one of the times he got in a lot of trouble and should have won it. I don't think I was as good as him, but you know how things go in some races. But what was surprising in the Don, he was even money and I was 50-1.
Yep. So yep.
That makes you go to the window.
And you did.
Yes, I did.
Yeah. Yeah, why not?
Jack Owens, the man that owned Little Bull John, lived in Florida during the winter, and he had 2 tables full of people that have never been to the races before. I mean, like 20 people. And he asked me, he said, what kind of race you have my horse in today? And I told him, I said, I really think we have a chance because we've beaten the favorite. I said, don't worry about the odds and don't worry about all the talk about the rest of them. So at that point, everybody at the table reached in their pocket and handed me money to bet on him. And Jack always bet $1,500 across the board every time he ever ran. So I probably had over 3,000 bet on him, and Exacta paid $500 with the favorite.
Wow.
But Andy Beyer come to me in the winner's circle and put a microphone and says, John, tell the truth. You knew you didn't have any chance in here. You're as shocked as I am. Tell the truth. And I said, just follow me, Andy. And I made him go to the window and watch me cash all those tickets. And when they put it in a bag and I walked away, I said to him, does that answer your question? So I'm sure he'll remember that. He left me alone for a while.
It's a great story. He is trainer Jerry Robb here on Trainer Talk presented by Fasic Tipton. If you look in the program, I think it says John J. Robb, but you go by Jerry.
Yeah, my middle name is Jerry, and that's what my parents, everyone's called me my whole life.
Yep.
I'll answer to both depending on who it is.
Let me mention a name to you, and you tell me what you remember about this horse, because if you look at all the greatest stakes victories that you've had in your career, Jerry, there are several. We talked about Little Bull John. You mentioned the name Lightning Paces earlier. Tell me more about Lightning Paces.
Lightning Paces was a horse that one of my clients that I trained for a long time, Morgan Wason.
Mm-hmm.
And that horse showed a lot of ability early. He had chipped his ankle. We took the chip out and gave him time, healed him up. And he ended up winning a lot of races for us, including the Virginia Derby on the turf. But he was a dirt horse. And the thing about that night when he won the Virginia Derby, he came out of like the 15 post and made the lead and still held on. So
wow.
That was what I remember about that night, coming from the far outside post and using him to get the lead and then still had enough to finish.
A special performance indeed, and a special horse was Lightning Paces, won the Grade 3 Baltimore Breeders' Cup in 2001 as well.
That horse had many, many stakes where he got beat a nose, too. I know the Maryland Million Classic, he got beat a nose a couple of times. A couple of stakes at Delaware, he got beat a nose. He had many, many close finishes.
Well, he got to the wire first in that one. One of the more memorable Preakness stakes, some people would say the most memorable, was the duel between Sunday Silence and Easy Goer in 1989, and you had a chance to participate in that race. Tell me about the horse and tell me about that day.
We had a horse called Pulverizing we ran in there. We knew he didn't belong, but the owners wanted to enjoy the day and have an opportunity to run there, so we ran him. And it was an exciting day. I mean, like I said, we weren't expecting anything, so it wasn't any disappointment involved. But the experience, they ended up following me and the horse all week long, which was different.
Yeah.
And I had a lot of fun with that. I took all my kids out and bought them new outfits, and I told the guy following, I said, don't take them tags off because they're going back Monday. So we had a lot of fun with that week, but that was a good race to be in, and we actually made the lead, I think, for a brief moment.
Yep. What was it like watching Sunday Silence and Easy Goer duel through the stretch?
It's good to go back and watch it now. At the time, I was watching mine, making sure I wasn't last. I didn't want to finish last, and I think I beat one horse, so that was good. I really didn't watch that duel. I was watching my guy.
Well, Pulverizing, squaring off against those heavy hitters in 1989. And our guest tonight is trainer Jerry Robb here on Trainer Talk. Jerry, you mentioned your kids. Are they involved in the sport in any way?
My son is. He had a van operation where he shipped horses all around. He's been assistant for a few people through the years. Right now he's working as my farm manager. I have just built a big breeding farm in Maryland, and he's working here with my wife.
Really? What's the name of the farm?
No Guts, No Glory Farm.
Ooh, I like that name. Where'd the name come from?
That was her stable when I married her. Mine was Hidden Hill Farm. Hers was No Guts, No Glory, so you know how that goes.
Where's the farm located?
It's in Woodbine, Maryland.
Which is where?
Half hour from Laurel.
Okay. All right, and you said you're going to, will it be a farm where you're going to stand stallions?
No, we have six brood mares here. I have Anna's Bandit's mom, one-arm Bandit here, all her foals, and she has a couple of her mares. I think we have six together, five in foal, and we've had four the last 2 years. We've only been open 2 years here.
Mm-hmm. What's the long-term goal with the operation? Where do you want to see it end up?
With the program here in Maryland, just to have horses that can compete and hopefully pay their way. Hope they all turn out like Anna's Bandit. She's the first one.
Tell me about her.
I bred the dam. I raised the mother, one-arm Bandit, did very well with her. I think she won her first four in a row. And then I didn't have a farm at the time when I retired her, so I sent her to West Virginia, a farm up there, and bred her, had her foal there for a West Virginia program.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have a Maryland program at the time. And so she's West Virginia sired, West Virginia bred, Maryland sired, so I get to run in all the Maryland bred races and the West Virginia races.
Ooh, nice.
Which works out pretty good. She's won stakes at both places.
Yeah, that works out great.
She went her first start. I took her to New York in a stakes. She clipped heels turning for home and was last and got up to finish third. And then I took her to Churchill and finished second in the stake there. And she had a little filling in one of her ankles, so I x-rayed her ankles and found that she had a fractured sesamoid as a weanling, which I knew nothing about. No one ever told me.
Oh, wow.
Before I did the surgery, I x-rayed the other ankle to make sure that was clean, and that one was fractured also.
Mm.
So she was never supposed to, they had to take a piece of her sesamoid out. So she was supposedly not make it back to the races. And now that's when I hold my breath every time she breathes or runs. Not that she soared, it's just that, you know, the surgeon said, you can try her, but I don't think you'll ever make it. And she's won about 10 races since then.
No, it's amazing. Yeah, amazing so, how they can overcome so much.
Yeah, I'm excited to see. I have her full brother on the farm who we named Little Bold Bandit. So he's got to live up to that name, and he's got to be half what she is. But I'm waiting to see what one sound would be like.
Yep. How about the name Pioneer Boy? When you hear that name, what comes to mind?
Pioneer Boy was a horse I claimed for Mike Gill,
mm-hmm.
and I went a few stakes with him, and I took him to Canterbury and won the Claiming Crown. Won the Breeders' Cup race at Preakness Day. I think I went 4 stakes that day. That was a big day.
Yep.
On Preakness Day. But he was a very fast, nice horse.
I've been waiting the entire show to bring up this next name to you because there's an interesting story behind this horse, and I'll let you tell it because I'm sure you can tell it far better than I can, but it was in 2013. The horse's name is Bullet Catcher. Tell me that story.
We had him as a 2-year-old. We bought him out of the sale. Belonged to my wife now. Wasn't a wife at the time. But he went his first start, and the way he won it, I thought he was going to be any kind of horse. I mean, he was dead last turning for home, and Pino rode him. He just eaten him to the outside, and he just circled the field to the stretch. So very impressive. I thought he could be any kind, but turned out it was a bunch of bums he beat. But he went on to win quite a few races. And I guess the story you're looking at, I had Jeremy Rose breathing one morning. I had him breathing one morning. My wife was in Disney World with her kids. And Jeremy come walking back to the barn. The horse had gotten loose from him. Well, the horse, they didn't get the gate closed in time. So he ran out of the stable gate and ran up Whiskey Bottom Road. Light turned green. He turned left, went down Route 1. We probably caught him 3 miles away, and this is rush hour traffic, 9 o'clock in the morning. And Abel Castellano was clocking him, following him in the car and clocking him with his cell phone at 30 miles an hour running down a concrete road. And, you know, when they do that, usually you figure that he'll be done. But he never fell, which is very rare. Usually horses hit the blacktop, they're down. He never lost his footing. And then we ran him back 2 or 3 weeks later in the allowance race, and the announcer said they couldn't catch him on Route 1 and they won't catch him today.
It's great. Great story. And the best part of the story is it has a happy ending because Bullet Catcher obviously was fine and came back to compete and to win another race, which is so cool.
Yeah, he won an allowance race after that happened. So
yep.
It didn't hurt him at all, which is amazing in itself.
Talking with trainer Jerry Robb here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. You can't make a story like that up. It actually happened. You can go out there and Google it. Bullet Catcher is the horse's name. And that video that you mentioned, Jerry, that Abel Castellano was taking is actually still out there. It may be the Baltimore Sun website or one of those. I actually watched it as I was getting ready for the program here tonight.
Could you understand Abel?
not really. But it was a fun watch anyway. It was something very unique. You kind of hold your breath, making sure everything's going to be okay. But knowing that it had a happy ending, it makes it easier to go back and watch now.
Yeah, I think you see a blacksmith in a pickup truck trying to grab him out of the window to grab the reins.
Yeah. It's crazy story. Absolutely bizarre story with Bullet Catcher. Jerry, if you were to put your finger on maybe the best trainer that you've had the chance to be around working day in and day out at the racetrack, who's the best trainer you've seen over the years?
As far as work ethic, I would say Dickie Dutrow was probably the top horseman I was around.
Mm-hmm.
One of the guys I came up under, Dickie Coit, was probably one of the best horsemen I've ever been around. And as far as working, I mean, Dale Capuano, no one's more dedicated than him. His life is the track. That's the only life he does have. And not married, no kids, and he's been doing as long, not quite as long as me, but a long time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's been many, many good trainers coming out of Maryland. They don't do all that well here, but they go everywhere else and do well, and that's Barkley Tag.
Yep.
John Forbes, John Tamaro, Leatherberry. I mean, he's a story in itself.
Yeah, how what's your relationship like with King Leatherberry?
Very good. He's a good friend of mine. He's a funny guy. And you know, everyone criticized the way he trained horses because he was never at the barn. He was more of a businessman, but he had good help at the barn, and he was the one picking the right spots and had the clients, and he went 6,000 races. How do you knock that?
I was there the day that he was inducted into the Hall of Fame. We actually did the radio broadcast of that Hall of Fame induction ceremony. And I remember he got up there and immediately started telling jokes, which is kind of his MO. And he was so fantastic.
Yeah, he is. Great guy.
What makes him such a good trainer?
Well, back in the day, there was what they called the Big Four here. And they had Grover Delp, Dickie Dutrow, Leatherberry, and Tamaro.
Okay.
And they had all the clients and all the horses, and they would win 100 races every meet. I mean, they claimed back and forth from one another, and it was good for someone like me because they were always taking an edge, and I could reach in and claim one I knew was well worth the money. You know, I wish those days were back.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess having the clients and the right kind of stable help. I mean, we all need good help in the barn, that's for sure. We can't do it all.
Yeah.
And that's key, and he's always had decent help and great clients.
How much has the game changed since you first got involved, Jerry?
As far as the clientele, it's changed a lot because back then you trained for large farms and people that had large outfits, and now you might have a horse that have 40 people and one horse.
Yeah.
And that's probably the biggest change that I've seen over the 40 years. You know, the syndicates and the partnerships and all, it's a good thing, but what a nightmare.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's tough enough to keep one owner happy, much less 40.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, that would be the biggest change. And like I mentioned earlier, the racing program in Maryland's, instead of 30% turf, it's 60-70% turf. So you got to learn to adapt with it.
So how have you been able to adapt and continue to be successful? What have you had to do?
Well, luckily, I haven't done a lot of adapting yet. Being in the Mid-Atlantic, I just run my horses, not this year, but the previous years. The dirt horses, I would ship them back and forth between here and Delaware.
Mm-hmm.
Couldn't run them here, run them in Delaware. And we've always had good success in both places with them. This year, I haven't had to ship because most of my young horses had shin problems this year, and they're really getting started now. And the turf horses, I just claimed a few just to keep, you know, balance so you have something to run.
Yeah. You know, Dale Capuano is a name that you mentioned, and you said that, you know, he's all about the training and the horses and doesn't have a, you know, he's not married, and this is his life. And so many trainers that have come on this program over the years have kind of said those same things. I like to ask trainers what they like to do outside of horse racing. And, you know, some people will tell you fish or baseball games or this or that or football, and they'll follow other sports. But by large, this is what they do. This is what horse trainers do, and this is their entire life. So I'm going to ask you that question, Jerry. Are there other interests that you have, even though you're dedicated to the horses, are there other interests that you have outside of horse racing?
lately, building the farm and all, I haven't done much of between the racetrack and the farm, but previous to that, I played a lot of golf.
Mm-hmm.
And I bought an airplane, got a pilot's license, and would fly back and forth to all the racetracks. That was probably the biggest hobby, those two.
Yeah. Do you still have the plane?
I just sold it like 3 months ago.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
How about golf? But do you still get a chance to play?
Pardon me?
Do you still get a chance to play much golf?
No, I haven't played maybe once all year, and last year maybe twice. But I mean, there was a time where I'd play 5 days a week.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when we weren't running.
Well, that's a good way to stay in touch with clients and owners, right? You can take them out on the golf course, enjoy a day, and be a little bit more in a more casual setting, I guess, than at the racetrack.
Yeah, they have three or four outings a year for that. The Maryland Million has an outing. The MTHA has a couple outings a year. I try to do some of those. But most of the golf I played, I was stabled at Bowie and the Capital hockey team practice right there at Odington.
Mm-hmm.
And those guys would quit skating at 10 in the morning. We quit training at 10 in the morning. We ended up meeting up and playing with those guys and becoming good friends with a lot of them back in the day.
Oh, that's cool. Are you a big hockey fan?
Yes. I trained for Arnold Hepp, who owned the Capitals.
Mm-hmm.
I trained for him for 20 years and went to probably every game during that 20 years. So became a big fan.
You still follow
and
him
then
today?
I got to know most of the guys playing golf with him, too. So it was fun, a lot of fun.
Yeah, you still get to follow him today?
Yeah, Craig Berube, I stay in touch with him. He's now the coach at St. Louis. He won the Stanley Cup, so.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think that's one of the neat perks of being a horse trainer is you do have a chance to be around some big-name people, some celebrities that we see in other industries. I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah, it is.
Well, Jerry, just about a minute or two left here, and we're going to wrap this up. That's been a relatively quick hour here, I would say, looking back on your career and some of those top moments. But when you look ahead to the future, what's the future hold for Jerry Robb?
I'm hoping all the mares that I breed throw me some decent horses. So I've got a few in the barn now I'm looking forward to. And, of course, Anna's Bandit's rolling good, and there's some nice races coming up for her. So I'm looking forward to the Maryland Mayhem with her and Charlestown Classic, a few big races for her coming up. And then we have the Delaware Certified races. Hopefully I have a few ready for that. So
Good.
Hopefully I have a decent fall.
Yeah, well, things are rolling for Jerry Robb, and he continues to click along, closing in on that 2,000 win milestone. Jerry, we appreciate the visit here tonight. All the best moving forward, and good luck with all those horses, and good luck getting to number 2,000.
All right, thank you very much.
All right, thanks, Jerry. Jerry Robb here on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton. Don't forget, if you missed any portion of the show, you can simply head over to our website. That's horseracingradio.net. You can listen to the podcast of this show and all of our Trainer Talk shows at your leisure. And like all of our guests, we're going to send Jerry a gift from Flair Equine Nasal Strip so he can try out those strips on all of his horses as he moves closer to win number 2,000. For our producer, Lee Delapina, I'm Mike Pena, coming to you from our Jimmy John's of Lexington studios. You've been listening to Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton, here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Until next week, thanks for listening.